الصلاة والسلام عليك.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. May the peace, mercy and blessings of Almighty God be upon you all. My name is Mohammed and I'm the president of the Islamic Society here at the University of Sussex. We are very honored to have you attend for the third consecutive talk of Sharia law for barbaric and misunderstood. I'm sure most of you have heard about Sharia law in one way or another, and this is why we have asked Brother Abdullah, the embassy, to come and talk. Brother Abdullah is a former Christian of Portuguese descent. He embraced Islam at a young age after a period of study that started when he was 10 years old. He has continued to study Islam in depth ever since. Abdullah has had a long experience of working in the Muslim community, and his activities involve studying, talking extensively theology, philosophy of science, sociology, anthropology, and political philosophy. Abdullah has delivered talks throughout the UK and has delivered talks throughout the United Kingdom and community centers, universities, colleges, and appeared on various TV programs. He also engaged in a number of debates with atheists, secularists, Christians on a variety of topics. He is currently a member of the MDI, or Muslim Debate Initiative, which is a public discussion forum that promotes open dialogue and debates. We are very honored to have him here today, and as we are to have him. The talk is going to start now. If you have any questions throughout the talk, please note the questions now. And you will have the chance to ask as many questions as you want to Abdullah. I'd like to remind you that we have some free pizza and free gifts for everyone attending afterwards, so please stick around. Without further ado, I pass it on to Abdullah. He's a bit old actually today, and this is why he preferred sitting down. So I'll pass it on to Abdullah.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم من جهه العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وعلى اله الطيبين وصحبه الصالحين. Hello, and I'd like to thank everyone for turning up to attend this event and for the Sussex ISOC for inviting me. It's a very interesting subject. I'd like to apologize that I'm feeling a little ill today, so I have to sit down. But hopefully, this shouldn't be my lecture. Basically, I think there's a very interesting question, and it's assumed in the media whenever you hear the word Sharia law mentioned, that it's something barbaric, it's prehistoric, it's a system which emanates from 1,400 years ago, and anything that's old, any old kind of system, is, you know, belongs in the past. We have to modernize and embrace new ideas and new systems. The interesting aspect to this is that democracy, as anyone who knows about democracy, is 2,500 years old. It predates Islam. In fact, Islam is more modern than democracy. Yet, democracy is viewed as the measure of modernity. So if you're not a modern democratic state, then you're not modern, which is kind of ironic. But I think the title is Sharia law, is it barbaric and misunderstood? Well, what does it mean by barbarism? What do we mean by this word? In the dictionary, we get the definitions, an act or trait or custom characterized by ignorance or cruelty, marked by crudeness or lack of restraint in taste, style, or manner, brutal, cruel, or lacking refinement. It originally comes from the Greek word barbaros, which means foreign, which is quite interesting. So we can break it down even further to what do you mean by cruel and brutal? Well, cruel is something disposed to inflict pain or suffering, or causing or suffering always painful, and brutal is extreme ruthlessness or cruelty, crude or unfeeling in a manner of speech, or harsh or unrelenting. So the way I'm going to answer this question is whether Sharia law is barbaric and misunderstood, is that I'm going to answer the question whether Islam is predisposed to inflict pain and suffering, whether it is lacking of refinement, or disorganized or arbitrary, whether it's cruel and doesn't take in the human condition of the weakness of human beings, and of course, is it harsh? Is it disproportionately punishing for the crime? So, and when I reach my conclusion, I will finish off by saying that Islam is anti-barbaric in its actual nature. And I'll do this for a number of five principles. One, I will elucidate to you Islam's understanding of human nature, that Islam is principled and not arbitrary. Two, that Islam organizes the family and women's and men's rights, so that we don't get this individualism structure whereby everyone's out for their own interests, which is more akin to a barbaric or anarchic kind of society, and one that's more organized. So it's Islam, inshallah, I will show that it is anti-barbaric in that sense. Islam is anti-barbaric in that it prevents exploitation of human beings to other human beings. So for example, Islam bans interest. I will go into that. And I will also show that the ruling system of Islam is anti-oppression of the minority, because as we know, in barbaric rule, the mob rule is the one which always operates. So if Islam is anti-mob rule and protects the rights of minorities, then it can't be barbaric, which is why I argue that we don't believe in democracy. And I will also show that Islam controls barbarism in society through its penal system. And lastly, and I suppose more controversially, is I'll show how the foreign policy of Islam is anti-barbaric, which is commonly called jihad. And I'll show you what jihad is used for and who against. The first point will be Islam's understanding of human nature. Before we discuss any system, be it communism, liberalism, social Darwinism, whatever system you have in mind, we have to understand human nature, because humans are the subject of that system. So it doesn't matter what I think, or you think, or anyone else thinks here about what is a great ideal or what sounds nice. We have to look at human nature and how we can address human nature. This is the criteria of judging any system. So let's start with the first assumptions. As we know, in Europe, the original context of Europe was that it was Christianity, well, at least 2,000 years ago. And in Christianity, the understanding of human nature was that all humans are evil. We're prone to being evil. And we're inherently evil, we have original sin. So we are a fallen man. So when Adam fell from grace, we are now Adam's fallen progeny, and we are now inherently evil. And only God, through a saving grace, can bring us back into communion with Him. The liberal conception of human nature was a reaction to that. Remember, liberalism emanated from a Christian context. So it was a rebellion against Christian understanding. And liberalism believed that human beings are inherently good. This was taken from ancient Greek philosophy. And that we are rational, we're inherently good, and the only thing that makes us bad is if we suffer oppression. But if we're not oppressed, then we are predisposed to act good. Now, this is very interesting. I'll refute these off the bat very quickly. One, if we are inherently evil, then it is morally wrong for God to create us and then punish us for our evil if we have no choice but to do evil. So the theology isn't consistent in the first conception. The second conception of human nature, liberalism, ignores the fact that human beings are not purely rational beings, but we're prone to being irrational beings, doing things which are counterintuitive all the time. In fact, most of our choices are made like this. But let's take it to a logical extent. If freedom makes us good, then who is the freest person on the world? Who are the most freest people in the world? They're dictators. Because dictators have no laws against them, right? No one's going to impose a law against them. No one's going to take them to court. You know, they are the court, they are the law system, whatever they say goes. But look how insane and tyrannical dictators act when their lusts are allowed openly to ravage society. So I would say that we're not inherently good or bad, and giving us freedom doesn't make us good. It makes us spoiled brats, it makes us tyrants, it makes us dictators. Our lusts for power, wealth, money and sexual reproduction have no limit. There's no limit. There's no limitation on these things if you want to unleash them. So what is now the Islamic conception of human nature? I've discussed Christianity, I've discussed liberalism. So what's the Islamic conception of human nature? Well, the Islamic conception of human nature is that human beings
we are, can be predisposed to doing good or evil. Sorry, we can do good or evil, but generically speaking, we are, you could say, empty slate, which we could do, we could fulfill our purpose through. And this is in line with the understanding of why God created us from the Islamic perspective. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, "I have not created man or jinn except to worship me." And in the hadith from the Prophet Muhammad, man was created upon the fitrah, the human nature. So just like any, imagine a new product you buy. You buy a new computer or a new television or a new whatever, any product. Now you can either throw the computer on someone's head out the window, or you can use it to send emails to people and do good things with it. The computer is neither inherently evil or bad, neither is a knife. A knife is not inherently evil or bad. You can cut butter, you can cut bread and feed it to the orphans, or you can kill someone with it. So a knife is not inherently good or bad, but a knife is predisposed to fulfill its purpose. And that's very much like human beings. It's very much how Islam understands human beings. But there is a problem. How should we be organized? How do we operate in society? How are we brought together and function to fulfill our purpose? Now, if we don't have any purpose, which if you're predisposed to an atheistic worldview, then it's basically, I don't know, luck of the draw, maybe it's chance, maybe whatever the case might be, there is no purpose. Society just forms spontaneously based on hierarchical power structures, based on the strongest filtering down to the weakest in any society, capitalism, social Darwinism, anarchy, whatever you want to consider. And so there is no organizing principle for society. Just let natural strength, a natural ordering process will come about without you needing to organize society. But if we do believe in a purpose, then we have to believe in principles which will organize human society. Now, if we believe we have a purpose, we need guidance. So we need to be guided upon this purpose. Now, because we believe in God, we believe that God gives us this guidance. And it is very interesting, because if we want to achieve the things that human beings, you can see them, are designed to achieve, we want to achieve peace. We all want to achieve peace. But how do you get to that peace? What kind of peace is it? Is it unjust peace where, you know, 10% of the world population take 80-90% of the world's resources? Is that kind of, that's peaceful too, but it's unjust peace. So what we need is basically justice, or human beings being appropriately dealt with according to our natures. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "True peace is not merely the absence of tension, it is the presence of justice." Again, Henri Frédéric Amiel, a Swiss philosopher, poet, and critic, said, "Liberty, equality, bad principles. The only true principle for mankind, and humanity is justice, and justice to the feeble is protection and kindness." Now, what is justice? How do you define justice? Everyone says we want justice, I believe in justice, but how do you define justice? Well, I think Stanley Fish, the American literary theorist and legal scholar, put this very interesting. He said, "I think it is fair to distribute goods and privileges equally, irrespective of the accomplishments of those who receive them. You might think it is fair to reward each according to his efforts. I think it is fair when everyone has a chance to speak. You might think it's fair when everyone who is qualified has a chance to speak. The disagreement between us cannot be settled by the invocation of fairness, because what divides us is our different views on what fairness actually is." So, all human beings disagree as to what is fairness, what is justice. Sometimes, or most of the time, we define justice by what is our own self-interest. So we need now an external criterion to tell us, to help us, to teach us what justice is. And in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says to mankind, "We sent our messengers with clear signs and sent down with them the book and the balance, so that men may conduct themselves with justice." Again, in Surah 2, 216, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "And you may dislike something which is good for you, and you may like something which is bad for you. God knows while you do not know." So basically, because we as human beings are very limited, we're very finite in our understanding, how do we know what will create the greatest good? The argument that utilitarians like to use is basically that you should always maximize the greatest good, which can justify doing some evil. You can do some evil to do a greater good in the future. Now, if you were a logical person who didn't believe in any higher power and didn't believe in any principles of morals, that sounds pretty fair. So I can go into a country, I can bomb, I can kill the people in that country, some of them, so that a better system for their future kids will emanate. But obviously, how do I know what the future will bring? I'm not a prophet. So I've actually caused more evil in the world with good intentions, despite my claim to know what is justice. So the man needs to be guided, and we need to be informed what justice is and how we can bring about this justice. So the purpose of these criteria is to allow man's nature to become fully realized. Freedom in Islam means the elimination of obstacles to full self-realization of one's purpose and one's nature. So we believe in freedom, but we believe, we all have different understandings of freedom, of course, but we believe in freedom, and the freedom for human beings is the freedom to fully realize ourselves as human beings, based on our purpose. Now, human beings are prone to deterministic behavior. What does that mean by this? I don't know if anyone studies psychology. Anyone studies psychology here? Psychology? No psych? One lady there. Anyone else? Yeah. Everyone's shy. Everyone's shy about the subject. According to your studies, are you first year, second year?
First.
Your first year, okay. Have you encountered in your studies of psychology again and again how human behavior can be predicted on external factors like how they were raised and the environment they grew up in and the ideas they were taught? And most human beings act according to factors they had no choice in. So for example, if they were abused as a kid, this might affect them later on in life, their relationships and so on and so forth. So yeah, you've heard this. Now, if we had a free will which kind of supersedes all these conditions, then fine, you know, human beings should be allowed to be put in any situation, no matter what temptation they're faced with, that's not a problem. Their free will always choose the good path, or the better path, or the moral path. But human beings tend to be weak, and we tend to be subject to deterministic factors, our conditions, our society. Most of you, your beliefs are conditioned by the society you grew up in. You didn't choose them. The fashions you're wearing, is this your own personal individual fashion, or is it the fashion of society that you grew up in? Are you really an individual, or are you part of a collective? So you have to ask yourself these questions. You know, and what's even interesting is quite funny, because in this society, they say everyone's an individual, yet everyone kind of dresses the same way and has the same beliefs. But you're all individuals, right? So this is the very interesting. It's kind of like me looking at the human body and saying that, no, the human body is not one thing, it's billions of things. It's billions of individuals, cells. Because each cell has its own warheads of energy sources, so it's separate from other cells, it has transactions with other cells. So why can't I say that the human body is not a bunch of individuals? So we are created with this inherent weakness. Islam understands that we have the capacity to choose, that we do have the capacity to choose, but we tend to always be swayed by our environmental conditions. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that Allah would make the burden light for you, for man was created weak. And the Prophet Muhammad said, I've been sent with an easy and practical sharia, a practical way of teaching. Now, Islam understands that human beings, we are weak, we can be swayed, we can be easily tempted to do bad things. So the purpose of the sharia is to now create an environment which will help us to be more moral beings, where virtue and not self-interest is the highest value and will be reinforced by the systems within that society. This is more in line with human nature. And as I said, anyone who studies psychology here, please feel free to rebut me that human beings are completely isolated from their context and they always develop individually. It's not the case. So human beings have an intrinsic nature with basic motivation to fulfill their purpose. And free will is the cause of good and bad in human beings, not nature. And humans are prone to deterministic behavior, so we're subject to herd mentality, peer pressure, and temptation. So we need a system now that helps us organize this. What is the basic unit of society? What do you think? What is the basic unit of society? What do you think is the basic building blocks of any society? Anyone?
Families.
Families? Oh, lucky kids. Usually they say it's individuals. Yeah, usually in liberalism, the concept is individuals are the basic building blocks of society. The individuals define society, not vice versa. The communists would argue back that you were born into a certain circumstance or situation. You had no choice in. You were born into a certain class, working, middle class, or whatever. So society defines you. That's what the communists would argue. But in reality, the real basic unit of society is the family unit, which is correct. And so while communism deals with the basic unit as being just society as a whole, liberalism deals with the basic units being individuals. But we all know that it is actually the family which is our first encounter with other human beings. When you were born, you encountered your mother and your father, and these were the individuals which gave you the initial introduction to the human reality. They nurtured you, they taught you language, they taught you most of the basic things that you use today. Now, Islam, because Islam is thought of as a totalitarian system, that it guides, it will basically get involved in every aspect of your life. This is incorrect. Islam, though it has guidance for every aspect of your life, but then again, every culture on the face of this planet has some kind of an idea or understanding of how you live, what's a nice spouse, what's a nice car, what's a nice whatever. But rather, Islam doesn't enforce families to act a certain way by the state. So Islam doesn't interfere with family life. So what you do in your own family is now the responsibility of each family. And there's freedom to each of the families. But Islam does get involved if there is abuses of responsibility within a family, because Islam wants to maintain healthy units, healthy families. So there is a family structure. Now, there's an ayah of the Quran which defines the relationship between, I think, the first basic, the units that which forms the family. The family is formed by a marriage between a man and woman. And the Quran, it says, and women shall have rights similar to the rights against them according to what is equitable. But men will have a degree of responsibility over them, and Allah is exalted in power and wise. Now, Islam does say that men are the protectors and maintainers of the family, and that women, within the family, they occupy the role within the family structure and unit of being the emotional stability of that family, being the fundamental base for reproduction and the future of mankind. But this seems to be very controversial in this society, which is very strange, because for a society that looks at science very favorably, what would a scientist say? Say aliens came down to planet Earth and they observed human sexual dimorphism. Dimorphism means the difference between the physical attributes of the sexes within a human race. So for example, with swans, for example, the male and the female swan look identical. And they're absolutely identical from the outside. Maybe, obviously with different genitalia, but they look identical, and they're the same strength and the same everything. And in animals which the male looks distinctly different, like for example in chickens with the cockerel, you have a much more of a polygamy aspect going on. And they've noticed that basically the more similar the male is to the female in any genus or species, there is the greater tendency there is for monogamy. But the more distinct the male from the female, the more tendency is for polygamy. This is what scientists have noticed. And they've also noticed that, obviously, it's obvious men generally, because of the testosterone, which is nature's steroids, we are generally bigger, faster, and stronger. Run 10% faster than women, for example, in athletics competitions and in strength and endurance. This is natural observation of human beings. I was any scientist here who studied human anatomy, you can please contradict me on this. That's fine. But this is how it is. What would an alien conclude? What would an alien conclude from this? They'll say, well, if you look at ants, some are soldier ants, some are worker ants, and there's the queen ant, right? You see this three distinct categories of species, right? So what would an alien conclude studying us? We were being studied. They would conclude that males seem to be there for defense and maintenance, and women, they're within the role of a family, they are there for nurturing and being the emotional stability of their family. So an alien would conclude that men are for protecting and maintaining the family. And this is not controversial to a scientist, not controversial to an alien, if they exist, but it seems to be controversial in this society, because we seem to assume that it's unfair that males are more stronger than women, and that you know men and women should both do exactly the same kind of tasks, whether it be military or in the fire service or whatever. And what's quite interesting, in the fire service in England, for example, I can't think of all the countries, but in fire service in England, a fireman is meant to be able to climb a ladder and carry a human being on his shoulder to safety. But they don't give that task to women in this society. So women aren't expected to climb ladders and rescue people from buildings by putting them on their shoulder and carrying down. It's very heavy, it's very labor intensive. So these are aspects of science which scientists can tell you, which is practiced by the institutions in this country, which no one makes a peep about. But Islam is viewed as being sexist because we try to recognize human nature in that males are stronger, they are they have higher endurance, and so they should be put for protecting and maintaining women, because women are the most important aspect of our society. There was once a guy approached the Prophet Muhammad and asked him, who should I give respect to? You know, out my parents. So the Prophet said, your mother. And then he said, and then who? And the Prophet replied, your mother. And then the guy, and then after that, and the Prophet again replied, your mother. And the guy was saying, you know, God's probably thinking to himself that, it's never going to stop saying this. But he asked him one more time. And then the Prophet said, and then your father. So women are actually viewed as highly respected in our society. It's kind of like the queen ant, so to speak, in an ant colony. And the soldiers, the workers, and the fighters are meant to protect and maintain the queen. This is how we view it in Islamic society. Now, what about the issue of equality? People think that just because you have different specializations, you're not equal. Ants don't ask themselves this question. Ants just do, right? They have different functions and they work for the greater good of their hive, right? But according to in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, I do not waste the deed of any doer among you, any male or female. The one of you is as the other. So God views the actions of men and women to be equal in his eyes. And he views the soul of men and women, obviously, by dint of that, to be equal. So we're all equal in the eyes of God. But if God gives us, there's not eyes of the Quran which says that God, if God gives money to a rich person, for example, and some people are poor in that society, God will ask more questions of the rich person when they give that money for a good cause. So if God gives you something, there's a higher responsibility expected from that. And hence that balances out. So it's not that, God gives men a strength and so we have it easy. No, we don't. In fact, we have it harder, because in a marriage, the husband is expected, has an obligation to support his wife. The wife doesn't have to pay her husband a penny, even if she's richer than him. And women are allowed to work as well. But obviously, because for men it's an obligation, people always seem to forget that women are allowed to work. They are allowed to work. The Prophet's wife, Khadija, she was a very successful businesswoman. And so this is something that's neglected, you won't hear in the media. Now in the West, freedom for a woman is to basically resemble a man. And they consider a woman successful if she acts just like a man. So she goes out clubbing, she sleeps with many partners, and she has a high-powered career, and so on and so on and so forth. Which I don't even think men should do that, let alone anyone else. So this is something which is unfortunate. But because there's this kind of dogmatic underbelief about equality means doing exactly the same things. It's not the case. Equality means that your status is equal to other people. But we're all naturally different. Some are more intelligent than other people. Some are bigger and stronger. Some have specialist skills, or better artists, or better mathematicians, or better what have you. Things which I don't have that you might have, things that you have that I don't, these are just natural inequalities in human beings which we can't escape. But what we can do is we can cooperate for the greater good with our specialisms. And this is what Islam does with everyone, men, women, and rich, poor, intelligent or unintelligent. Now, this is the organization of the family and unit. In general, there's also community relations. So Islam tries to organize how human beings interact with each other, even outside of your family. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, O you who believe, let not a people ridicule other people, for they may be better than them. Nor shall any woman ridicule other women, for they may be better than them. Nor shall you mock one another, or call each other names. Evil indeed is the reversion to wickedness after attaining acknowledgement. Anyone who does not repent, then these are the transgressors. So Islam says you must be polite to people, strangers. You must help people. You must smile. The Prophet said you must smile as a charity. You must also respect the rights of your neighbors. You must, you know, a person who goes to sleep while his neighbor is hungry does not have faith. This is what the Prophet Muhammad said. In this society of individualism, we don't really care about our neighbors. We only care about number one, unfortunately. So Islam tries to get human beings to interact and actually to be polite, be respectful. This is a human right. In this society, you don't have the right to be respected. You don't have the right. You can be insulted by the newspapers, you can be offended, you can be slandered to some extent. If you are rich enough to obviously take them to court, you can. If you're not, which is most of us, you can't defend yourself and your reputation. So, this is Islam's community values and how it builds up in the family. And also, I just want to make a very quick point. If families are not protected and families are allowed to break down, what kind of problems arise from this? What kind of issues do we see? We see juvenile delinquency on the increase. We see crime. There was Mr. Justice Coleridge, who was a judge, a British judge, comments on social breakdown. He said, on a scale, depth and breadth, the breakdown of the English society is on a scale, depth and breadth, which few of us could ever have imagined, even a decade ago. It is a never-ending carnival of human misery, a ceaseless river of human distress. Professor Douglas Bisharov, University of Maryland, said, overall, what I see is a situation in which people, especially children, will be much more isolated because not only will their parents both be working, but they will have fewer siblings, fewer cousins, fewer aunts, uncles. So over time, we're moving towards a more individualistic society. And some mental conditions such as narcissism is reported to have increased by 30% since 1987. And obviously I can quote you crime statistics and rising crime statistics, but obviously I think you're already aware of them. So, and all this starts with the family. Single parents are very bad for teaching children. It's a plain fact. So the marriage is an institution that must be protected. Now, the penal system of Islam, and this is actually one of the subjects which people often cite as Islam being very, very, very barbaric. Islam's very horrific, its penal system, how it punishes people. They say it because they think that it's somehow more enlightened to put a whole bunch of, probably highly testosterone males into a cage for a number of years, and that's more enlightened, depriving them of their freedom. And it doesn't even work because I think the statistics says 75% of people, offenders who leave the punishment system re-offend. And they even have learned some extra tricks from other criminals within the prison. So prison becomes a criminal university, unfortunately. If you survive that system with your dignity intact. So we don't believe in incarcerating human beings in cages. The punishment system in Islam is designed to be very immediate and mostly symbolic and mostly preventative because the punishment systems are unimplementable. I'll give you an example. The punishment for adultery, very controversial. And as you know, the most sacrosanct institution in Islam is the family. If a husband or wife cheats on their spouse, this is a very grave matter because it undermines the institution of marriage. It causes an immense emotional pain to their spouse. And it breaks up families. And it destroys trust. If there's no trust anymore, then that's the end of the family. Now, the punishment is a capital punishment, which is basically an execution punishment. But what they don't tell you is what the required evidence before you implement that. Well, you know what they don't tell you is that you need four witnesses. Four witnesses that saw both the man and the adulterous woman or man committing the action. Four witnesses. And their stories all have to add up. They all have to be absolutely identical. that's virtually impossible. It is impossible to get four witnesses to it. It's extremely rare. In fact, the only time that we know in the time of Prophet Muhammad that there was anyone who was ever punished for adultery was when people would come up to the Prophet Muhammad and admit it and say, could I be punished? I've done this. Could you punish me? Because I was scared of being punished by God in the afterlife. And the one famous case, the guy approached Prophet Muhammad and said, I have committed adultery, could you punish me? And the Prophet Muhammad turned his head. And he goes like, no, I've committed adultery, punish me, please. And the Prophet Muhammad just turned his head again. And the guy repeated it again. And said, please, I've committed adultery, will you punish me? And the Prophet Muhammad turned again. And the guy kept on doing it. And then the Prophet Muhammad turned to him and said, are you insane? And he goes, no, I'm not. He said, well, look, if you had just kept it to yourself, I would have asked God to forgive you. But because you've made it now public, now you've shouted it out for everyone here, that now we have to punish you, now you have to be punished. The aim of this, the punishment system, is not to punish. It's to prevent. It's to show you how grave it is. But you'll never get four witnesses, ever, that will find anyone committing adultery. I mean, unless you commit adultery in the middle of a stadium or something, during half time. if you think that matches that boring, well. But it's not designed, as I said, it's not designed to be practical. The punishment doesn't seem to be designed to be implemented. It's designed to be just a warning. It's almost symbolic. Also, other aspects, murder, for example. In this society, if you commit murder, there is no forgiveness. You will be punished by this society, the penal system. In Islam, the family of the person you've killed has the option to forgive you. And the same goes with theft as well. They have according to the Maliki school of thought, there's an option to forgive. There is forgiveness. Islam allows those who you've hurt them to forgive you for committing the ultimate crime. But in this society, there is no option for forgiveness. Now, obviously, which one would be barbaric? Is it the system that has forgiveness or the one that doesn't? Which one do you think is the more barbaric system? John, if you think now that capital punishment is quite harsh, I want to remind you that John Stuart Mill, who is a great liberal political philosopher, himself was against the abolition of the death penalty and capital punishment in England, because he felt that if you lifted it, there would be an increase of crime in England. And it kind of turned out to be true. He was right. Getting sent to prison, where you have all the luxury modern conveniences, is no longer an adequate deterrent to crime. But our prisons are now filled to overflowing. America, for example, has the highest prison population in the world. And compare that to China, which is four times bigger the population, and is industrialized, and has cameras everywhere, and has state monitoring of its citizens, and it has the biggest population, one beats China. So you have to consider these kind of facts. And also with the issue of theft in Islam, the penal system for theft, the cutting of the hand. People think that cutting the hand of a thief, again, which has certain criteria, is a barbaric. But let's understand the context to this. In an Islamic state, the acquisition of material wealth is not seen to be virtuous. And if you stole because you were poor, or you were hungry, or you stole from a public place, like for example, someone left their watch on the table when I nicked it, for example, that's not punished. And there's even a minimum amount of money you have to steal, which is I think 1/4 of a dinar, which is a gold coin. You have a minimum amount before you can be punished. There's literally 7 criteria that you must fulfill before you can even be considered to be punished for this. So in essence, the only people who will be punished for theft are career criminals who steal for luxury, not those who steal for necessity. Because if you steal for necessity, then it's the fault of the state. They should have provided for you. The state should have provided for you if you stole for necessity. But if you steal for luxury, because you get a quick buck and you want to buy luxury cars and what have you with stolen goods, then this is the person, it's targeted, the career criminal, the one who does it not out of necessity, but does it for luxury, does it just because they are greedy. And the cutting of the hand is not meant to be the barbaric aspect. It's because what do you steal with? What do you use when you steal? It's your hands. So if you cut one hand off, this deprives you of the means of disrupting the economic system of that society, i.e. by stealing equipment. So this is basically why Islam has these rules. There's always a context. It's not done arbitrarily, it's not done for because it's gross or whatever. It's done because it has a preventive measure. Now, there are basically the prohibition of interest in Islam. So, how am I for time, by the way? 10 minutes, okay. The prohibition of interest in Islam. Interest is seen as one of the greatest evils in Islam. It allows the disproportionate wealth to happen between human beings and exploitation of human economic endeavors. In the Quran, there's many verses where Allah says that Allah has declared war. God has declared war on people who deal in interest. And there are many verses of the Quran which talk about, and hadith, which talk about that the desire to prohibit wealth circulating only amongst a few of human beings. So wealth must be circulated to all human beings as best as possible, because we all have rights to our basic requirements. Now, Islam is not just a spiritual faith, it has aspects of political guidance. One of them is the economic system. And Allah says in the Quran, "But seek the abode of the hereafter in that which Allah has given you, and do not neglect your portion of worldly life, and be kind even as Allah has been kind to you, and seek not corruption on the earth." Unlike capitalism, Islam does not believe that human beings have infinite wants and there are finite resources. Does anyone study economics here, or economics of business? Anyone? You, sir. Okay. Would you say that's a fair statement of the human economic problem, which is infinite needs and limited resources?
I was actually thinking of a question for later when you're talking, so...
Alright, no problem. Well, this is what capitalism defines as the basic problem, that there's infinite, humans have infinite needs and there are limited resources. So, the only aim of it, human production is to basically maximize resources, i.e. maximize production, and hopefully it will trickle down to everyone. Everyone will get their fair share. But the problem is, what we know, is that people who have a big share can buy even more bigger shares, and there's basically an exponential increase amongst those who are rich with the material and capital, and there are still an extremely large amount, a disproportionately large amount of people who are poor, who don't even have their basic needs met. Now, what does Islam do? Islam actually divides basic needs and luxurious needs. So, for example, do you need the latest Apple iPhone? Is this a human need? Will you die if you don't have it? You know, I know some people who are Apple-holics here probably will think like this, but you won't. Contrary to popular belief, you need food, clothing, and shelter as a very basic, and after that you need healthcare, education, and a reproductive partner. The Islamic system, it aims to guarantee for all human beings. After that, it's to do with your luxuries. You're free. The system allows you to freely compete to obtain luxuries, but it will guarantee all your basic human needs, which are finite and not infinite. Because food, clothing, shelter, how much food do you need to eat? How much shelter do you need? Do you need a broke grand palace? You don't. How much clothing do you need? You know? But we're told in this society that you have to keep buying, right? We keep being consumers because we're infinite, we have infinite needs. It's not the case, we don't have infinite needs. So, there is enough to satisfy all the needs of human beings on planet Earth. And the Prophet Muhammad said that the son of Adam has no better right than that he should have a house wherein he may live, a piece of clothing where he may hide his nakedness, and a piece of bread and some water. In another narration, that Muslims are partners in three things: water, pastures, and fire, i.e. energy, or natural energy. And the Prophet Muhammad made a distinction between private resources and public resources. So resources which are natural in the earth, which can benefit all of us, cannot be owned privately. So the Prophet Muhammad said, whoever prevented the excess water to prevent with it the excess pasture, Allah will prevent him on his or the bounty on the day of judgment. I.e., if you owned a well or an irrigation system which has more water than you require for your lands or your farms, and you prevent the excess water from getting to your neighbor's farms and lands, then you're going to be punished by God on the day of judgment, basically. It is prohibited. So you must give the excess of the natural resources to your fellow human beings. And then, even after the guarantee of all these needs and the prohibition of interest, which and also gambling, which also is a prohibitive means of ownership, because again, as they say, the house always wins, right? The gamblers, the people who host this gambling, they make money off of your property. So what Islam aims to do is that after eliminating these means of ownership, it allows you complete freedom. Anyway, after interest has been forbidden and gambling has been forbidden and monopolizing the public resources, everything is open, free market. In this society, there's, it's a free market, but this regulation, that regulation, that regulation, that regulation, that regulation. It's actually very regulated, the so-called free market of capitalism in this society, the post-Keynesian economics. But in Islam, after these prohibitions are made of no interest, no gambling, and no monopolizing of public resources, it's all free, do as you wish. And then there'll be a natural distribution of resources. And finally, there will still be rich people in that system, and there will be what you call relative poverty in that system. And the final stopgap measure to prevent an inequality of wealth developing, there is the institution of the zakat tax, which is a tax for basically rich people, which they must pay towards poor people, and I'll approach the ayah where they are to be distributed to. The zakat are only for the poor and the needy, and those who collect them, and those whose hearts are to be reconciled, and those and to free the slaves and the debtors, and for the way of Allah and for the wayfarers. So basically, the money for zakat, which is the tax on rich people, is basically for those who are poor, needy. The people have to go around collecting them as just the basic wage. To free people from slavery, for people who are in debt and can't get themselves out of debt, and for people who are on journeys and they've run out of money, they can't get back to their places of where they live. So these are basically where the rich tax gets paid to. And this is the basic final stopgap measure to enable circulation of wealth. And as I said, the ayah which talks about the circulation of wealth is Surah Hashr, ayah 7, where it says, lest it circulate solely amongst the wealthy from amongst you. So it says, well, it's a wealth we want to prohibit it from circulating only amongst the wealthy from amongst the human beings. Now, the next discussion is the ruling system of Islam. We are not democratic. That is true. But that's because we don't believe that minorities should be oppressed by a majority will. If you look at, let's say, Switzerland's a very democratic place. It's got representative democracy. Yet the public voted, for example, for the banning of minaret construction. And at some point, they're going to probably ban burkas. They undercut the rights of a minority because the majority wanted it. In America, it's the Constitution was instituted because the founders of America didn't trust democracy. They said that it could be mob rule. Thomas Jefferson made a famous quote about that democracy not mob rule, where 51% of the majority take away the rights of the 49%. Now, in Islam, you could say the Sharia is kind of like a constitutional democracy in that sense, like America. But the Sharia itself, the written law, is the constitution. And no human being, not the leader himself, is above the law. No one's above the law. And no majority can override the law. So if we want Christians to basically, let's say, stop eating pork, we can't prohibit them because Islam says that Christians are not to be under our law. Christians don't believe in Sharia, they are given their own system within the Islamic State, with Islamic multiculturalism. Whereas in this state, they believe it's fair to say, no, it's one law for everyone. All must submit to one law. Well, I'm sure the communists would agree with you as well. I'm sure Stalin would agree with that as well. I'm sure the Nazis would agree with that as well. They all believe in one law for every single person. But is it fair that I impose my law on someone else? Is that fair?
No.
Yeah. So if I don't believe in secularism, but I must adhere to what, let's say, France says secularism is, I can't pray in public because it's ostentatious prayer in public. I can't go, but I'm not allowed to build mosques where I can pray indoors. So where's my rights? Oh, this is a secular country. You don't like to get out. Right, that's fine. I don't mind if France wants to be secular, but just don't say you're free.
Just don't fool everybody to say, no, we're a free country, but you must follow our customs, our culture, our beliefs, our... Wait a second, that's not freedom. That's your customs, your culture, your beliefs. Now, in Islam, we don't believe that everyone must follow a law they don't believe in. Right? You follow a law that you do believe in. If you're Muslim, you follow Sharia. If you're Christian, you follow whatever the Christian institutes of law. And if you're Jewish, you follow Judaism. So Islam does not believe in a democracy where the majority overrule the minority's rights. However, it does believe in consultation with the public. So the Quran says, discharge your affairs by mutual consultation. So if the caliph, which is the leader in the Islamic State, which is elected, by the way, by the people, by consultation, wants to institute any policy, they must first consult the people. There was this French ambassador, I think it was in the 1600s, who complained to King Louis, I forget which King Louis it was, of France, that the Ottoman state was very difficult to work with. Because whenever we wanted them to pass a policy of a trade policy, which would be beneficial for France, the Ottoman state, the Ottoman caliph, didn't agree to it until he had consulted every single one of the guilds, the Merchants Guild and the Trade and the Traders Guild and the Shipwrights Guild, all these different guilds. He had to consult everyone first before he could get back to him and agree on a policy or not. So I used to complain, so that, like, this is not like France where we can just say yes, the king will just say yes and then we're done. No, the Ottomans consulted with everyone and with the people who needed to be consulted with. So we believe in a consultative leadership, but not, we don't call it democracy because we don't believe, as I said, in the majority rules. Now, I'll just finish up with the discussion of jihad. Islam believes, and I think I'm going to firstly discuss what Islam is, what jihad is for. Jihad means a struggle, yes, and it can be applied in various contexts. But the meaning, it's a Sharia meaning, is of course fighting. It is foreign policy of the state. Every ideology, whether you're liberal or you're communist or whatever, everyone believes for some reason to fight against other nations. The question is, what is the reason to fight against other nations? What makes you fight against other nations? Is it because they have oil wealth or resources? Islam doesn't believe that's a legitimate reason to kill people. For we don't believe that you should fight people for their resources or their wealth. And Allah says in the Quran, Surah 60, Ayah 8, Allah forbid you not, with regard to those who fight you, not for your faith, nor drive you out of your homes, from dealing justly and kindly with them, for Allah loveth those who are just. So Allah does not forbid you from dealing kindly and justly for those people who do not fight you for your beliefs. And they don't drive you out of your homes. And in another ayah of Quran, Surah 4, ayah 90. Except for those who reach a people between whom you have a covenant, or if they come to you with a reluctance in their chest to fight you or to fight their own people, had God willed, he would have given them strength and they would have fortune. But if they retire from you and did not fight you and they offer you peace, then God does not make for you a way against them. So if you meet people and they want to be peaceful with you, Allah does not give you an excuse to fight them. There's no reasoning your way out. Oh, I think they have weapons of mass destruction. I have no evidence, but I've got this thesis which has been sexed up. That says so. Yeah? No. There ain't no going around God's law. If people are peaceful and they want to be peaceful with you, Muslims cannot wage jihad against them. It is forbidden. But who can we fight against? Well, here's what Allah says in the Quran. Ayah 4, so it says Surah 4, Ayah 75. And why should and what is wrong for you that you fight not in the cause of God for the weak and the oppressed amongst men who and women and children who say, Our Lord, rescue us from this town whose people are oppressors, and give us from you a protector, and give us from you a helper. So it says, what is wrong with you that you do not fight against the oppressors who hurt people, and these people cry out to God and say, God, please rescue us from this oppressor, rescue us from this bad situation that we're in. And as Muslims, we have an obligation to anyone on this earth who's suffering under oppression to fight on their side, irrespective if they have natural resources or not. And the ayah of the Quran doesn't say, what is wrong for you that you fight not for Muslims? No, it's very general. It says, for the oppressed amongst men and women and children. It's general. We're all men, women, and children. We're not only Muslims are men, women, and children. It's general to all humanity. And even though we might fight, there are limitations. Fight in the cause of God those who fight you, but transgress not the limits, for God loveth not the transgressors. We have limitations with the Prophet Muhammad established. And he established his limitations as in, you can't kill women and children, you can't kill the guy who's just tilling the earth on his farm and do nothing. You can't kill monks who are just in their monasteries and they're devoted to their spiritual devotion. You can't kill any of these people. In essence, all you can kill is someone who basically has a sword running, who's basically in front of you and he's fighting you. This is the only people you can kill. No one from amongst the civilian population at all whatsoever. In conclusion, I will give you something which I think shows you a case for anyone who is a non-Muslim scholar and historian, and what he remarked about Islamic civilization. His name is Richard W. Bulliet, and he noted in his book the case for Islamo-Christian civilization, that minutely studying case after case, they have shown that justice was generally meted out impartially, irrespective of religion, official status, or gender. And not being subject to the Sharia, Jews and Christians were free to go to their own religious authorities for the adjudication of disputes. But in many cases, they went instead to the Islamic judge. And I think lastly, within this multicultural system that Islam proposes, there is also courtesy between different beliefs. So in Surah 6, Ayah 108, the Quran commands Muslims, do not curse the idols, referring to the polytheists, who are set up beside God, lest they blaspheme and curse Allah out of their ignorance. For Muslims, we hate polytheism. Obviously, as anyone reads the Quran, we're all about monotheism. But we are not allowed, as Muslims, to curse or insult polytheists or the polytheistic religion or their gods. We're not allowed to do it. The Quran itself is telling us, do not insult their gods. This is religious respect. We can dialogue and debate our differences intellectually, and in Islam, for example, very famous in Baghdad, there were atheists and Christians, and they were coming in public and they were debating Muslims on a variety of subjects. Christians came to the Prophet's mosque during the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and refused and denied the Prophet to his face that he's a prophet of God, and they were even allowed to pray their Christian prayer in the mosque and peacefully go about their business, and they came from Najd originally. So the Prophet Muhammad started off the institution of open debates and dialogues between Muslims and non-Muslims, free intellectual discussion, but not gratuitous insult. We live by the rules of intellectual integrity, not the rules of the playground. And unfortunately, people mistake freedom of speech for freedom to or insult. And this is not the case. So, I think I've demonstrated that Islam is not barbaric. I haven't covered everything, but I'm sure that there is a principle behind everything that Islam believes in. There is an organizing set of rules with a higher wisdom that Islam seeks to achieve. And that if you look at Islam in its context and you look at human nature, you'll find that Islam is not barbaric, it's actually anti-barbaric. It's there to prevent the barbarism of human beings who are under unnatural systems that causes them to act greedily with an infinite number of needs which must be fulfilled by bombing and killing people around the world for those needs. If you look at the world today, yes, for example, certain societies might seem very ordered, but what do their armies do? And their armies go to other countries and they take their resources and they kill people for those resources. So I think the question that we should all ask ourselves is that who is really barbaric? A civilization that goes around killing people for resources, or a civilization that tries its best to organize human beings, taking into account their intrinsic weaknesses? Thank you.
Yes.
So in a society, if a society like this were to adopt this idea of having no interest, how does a man who needs something to better himself, so say he wants a further education, how does he obtain it if he can't afford to pay cash? How does he get a loan?
Okay. Well, basically, I can't really talk about this society because a lot of things need to be changed fundamentally economically before you implement an entire economic system with an entirely new value system underpinning it. So I can't talk about this site, but what I can talk about is Islamic education in the past. So I'll talk about medieval Islamic education. And how it worked was that basically everyone was entitled to Islamic education. The state paid for it. If you wanted to continue education at a high level at Islamic University, and Islam was famous for having the earliest university systems, the modern university system as we know it today, then this again will be funded by the state, or it could be contributed by a temporary loan with no interest on it that we pay back the exact amount. So there are a variety of ways. They had wakaf, which is trusts, which we have a similar system in here, even here, whereby you could take scholarships, and there were scholarships for people who wanted to be academics and so on. So generally speaking, it is the state's obligation to ensure that every human being within that state has access to the education required to bet themselves and to contribute to society. And if they are unable to provide for themselves, then there could either be a temporary loan, which is pay back the exact amount, or they could benefit from the many scholarship systems, which there was actually, because Islam has a lot of religious encouragement for rich people to pay money into wakaf or trusts, that we had an abundance of trust. There was no one that went without in the Islamic system. And in fact, we had better literacy rates in the Islamic world in medieval times than we do now, which is quite funny.
Any other questions?
Thank you for your speech. I especially found your comment on the family unit interesting. Especially when you were saying that single parents cannot be as good parents as when they were married, and connecting that to my own context, I was raised by single parents, I have a stepfamily and so on. So what would you then say if in a marriage the partners just feel, love is gone or whatever, is it better for the sake of the family and the children to stay together and have an unhappy marriage? Or what would you say, what does the Quran say?
Okay, well, I'm not being an agony aunt in that sense, but what I would say is divorce is allowed in Islam. And there were many, at the time a woman approached the Prophet Muhammad, because Prophet Muhammad was acting as a judge and a leader as well, so he'd see court, he'd see different cases. So a woman approached Prophet Muhammad and said, I want to be divorced from my husband. And he asked, why do you want to be divorced from your husband? And she says, oh, because I don't love him anymore. I don't need him. So he saw the guy, and the guy was really loved her and was crying about it. And so he just, played it as an intermediary and said, are you sure you don't want to take him back? You don't want to be sure? And she goes, she asked him, are you saying this to me as a prophet of God that I must accept and I must take him back? Or are you saying this to me as just an intercessor? And he goes, I'm just an intercessor. And he said, well, then I don't want him anymore. I want to leave. It's all right. They were divorced. So the Prophet Muhammad understood, but obviously I'll say God, obviously, if you believe in God. I mean, God understands human nature, and that's why divorce is allowed in Islam. It's looked down upon, but it is allowed. And if the woman and the man don't love each other, or the woman doesn't love the man, or the man doesn't love the woman, or whatever the case might be. But there is more encouragement for the man who might not love his wife to stick with his wife and not abandon her than there is for the woman. Because the man has taken on responsibility on himself to look after that woman. And in that situation, it is allowed, this is why there was allowed, that instead of throwing her off the curb, that maybe you take a second wife, once you obviously with consultation, of course, you could take a possible second wife so that you don't divorce your first wife and throw her out in the streets, so to speak. Yeah, but if a woman doesn't like the man, then, bye-bye, husband, it's a woman's choice. You see, so in that sense, the priority is for the man to basically stay with his wife rather than the wife stay with the man.
May I respond to that? But it's also recognized that hulu divorce that initiated by women is more difficult than divorce by men, right?
Okay. Basically, there's two kinds of divorce. Basically, the man who says, the husband who says, you can pronounce divorce and twice saying, I divorce you, and they're divorced once. And the woman who goes to a judge and gets divorced, which is, we know from the Prophet Muhammad said, no, you can't divorce your husband. He never said that. So it should be easy for the man and the woman. But here's the thing. If the man gets angry with his wife and just goes, oh, I divorce you, and he just says that kind of that statement, then the divorce happens because women deserve a guy who's not reckless and is not just arbitrary and says stuff and has emotional problems. Women deserve stability. Right? But if a woman wants to divorce the husband, they will check, they'll look into this, what's happening, can we change the husband, make sure that he sticks with his wife? Is there anything that he's not doing that he should be doing to make sure that the wife is happy? But if the husband just willy-nilly wants to divorce his wife, then women deserve better than a man who's just reckless and is not wanting to step up to his obligations as a husband. But that's the case there. I think the best analogy I'll give it is that if you look at those film stars, all right, like a female film star, like a Whitney Houston, who just passed away. In her film Bodyguard, right? She fell in love with her bodyguard, right? The thing is this, if the bodyguard doesn't want to do his job anymore because he's having issues, yeah, then the woman should not have a conflicted bodyguard who doesn't know what he wants to do and always is all over the place, because she deserves protection and 100% commitment. But let's say if the star is unsure about her bodyguard, maybe the bodyguard can do further training as a bodyguard, maybe he can improve, maybe he can change, you see? So from this aspect, because women are so precious, if a man is reckless or not stable, she should not suffer that kind of a husband. And so they make it easy for the man to divorce. There's no playing around with that. But if you're a wife and you want to divorce your husband, well, check to see if the husband can be changed or improved, if there's something that can be corrected. If not, fine, that's divorce allowed. But I will say this, in today's Muslim society, which is very far removed from the Islamic ideal of our medieval times, in fact, it's not in our medieval times, we were much more enlightened than we are now, women find it very difficult to get divorced. And the judges are pro-men all the time. And judges are almost exclusively men as well, which is strange because women can also be judges. Women in the medieval times, they can also be even like hadith scholars and Islamic scholars and so on and so forth. So this is like of today's world, so do not confuse today's Muslim world, which is suffering from 500 years of civilizational decline, to what Islam says. They are two very different things.
Any other questions? Let's go on that side. Okay.
Could I ask, do you think is that right, that if the person changes, for example, from Islam to other religion, that he should be punished for that?
Or that change? Okay. The old chestnut question. Alright. Basically, Islam doesn't view it as, oh, someone changed their religion and they get punished for it. This is not how it looks at it. The law, which they call the apostasy, it's apostasy law, it's called the treason law, the law against sedition of that society, is only instituted in a society, in an Islamic state, not instituted by Muslims, not instituted by individuals like us. We have no authority to implement any of the Sharia law. That's for a specific context. And the context is, in all the narrations where we see people who suffered this, they were people who were basically trying to undermine the Islamic society by instigating problems, by dealing with the enemies of the Muslims and trying to open back doors for invasions and Muslims being killed. Things like these. These are the people who... it's treason. And in common Western law, they call it treason. In America, in theory, you're still punished. It's still punished by death in America, the law of treason, even to this day. So this is what it is. And I'll give you an example. A Bedouin approached the Prophet Muhammad, having just converted to Islam for one day. And then he said, Prophet Muhammad, I want you, release me from my pledge to be a Muslim and to practice and do all this stuff. Release me. And the Prophet Muhammad denied him. And he goes, release me. The Prophet denied him. And he released me. The Prophet denied him again. And they're like, fine. And they just walked off. And he was allowed to go outside of Medina, which was the Islamic state at the time, and freed on his way because he didn't like Islam, so he left. That's not sedition. That's not treason. That's you don't like the Islam, then you can leave Islamic system state because the whole system is based on Islam. If you don't like it, you can go to a non-Muslim area. That's fine. So it's only against sedition and treason, not against apostasy, and that context has been completely misunderstood. And I think I know why it's misunderstood, because in European history, the Christianity, or the political form of Christianity, had a kind of apostasy law. So we know that, for example, my conservators
who denied the Trinity, and he was a Unitarian Christian, was killed by John Calvin for his beliefs. He was burned at the stake by John Calvin. And this was because he rejected a Christian belief. Whereas in Islam, you didn't see any Inquisition courts or anything like that for people who've left Islam or whatever. None of that ever happened. No Spanish Inquisition, no testing of people's faith and how good a Muslim or Orthodox Muslim you know. You don't see that at all whatsoever. So this is the misunderstood context. And I think it's because of kind of European history has colored how people understand this this idea. But in essence, it's treason law.
Okay.
Okay, that's a very good question. You get asked a lot. Why is Islamic society or Muslim society in decline now? Well, the worst thing that ever happened to the Muslim civilization was success. In the 1500s, we were politically, military, scientifically, technologically, economically dominant in the world. It was said by a historian that if aliens came down to Earth in the 1600s, they would have thought that Islam was about to take over the entire world. It was three massive empires, and this was loads of Muslims. And they were at the cutting edge of technology in all spheres. But basically, the worst thing that happens to any civilization is, and if you can read Ibn Khaldun's book, Muqaddimah, or Induction to History, written in the 1400s, considered to be the grandfather of sociology, he noted that basically when a civilization reaches a level of comfort and luxuriousness, that it starts to become lazy, atrophy kicks in both thinking and in action. So the people stop being dynamic, they stop being cutting edge, they start just sitting back, resting on their laurels of past glory, and with their finite wealth they've amassed over the generations, slowly declines, until you reach a point where their enemies then become superior to them, and then they invade. The enemy, usually they are barbarians. This is how empires collapse or civilizations collapse. And the Muslim world had 500 years of civilizational atrophy. So 500 years of intellectual decline. The best scholars, the best example, Islamic scholars today are not the equal of the average scholars in the medieval Islamic times, which is why we revere our classical scholars so much, because they were virtual polymaths. They were geniuses, whereas the scholars we have today are not the equal of. I mean, there might be a few, one or two, or obviously, no one. But this is the problem. You see, and anyone who reads our classical scholarship, classical Islamic scholarship, for example, and our current scholarship, will see a very big difference. You'll see a big difference between the level of writing, the depth of writing. When you are a classical Islamic scholar, you studied psychology, you studied sociology, you studied politics, you studied a whole number of disciplines, and to be an Islamic scholar, yeah, and we don't have that today. We don't have this broad-based thinking. This is what I write on for revivalism, which my colleague mispronounced. But that's all right. But revivalism is, in essence, what the Muslims are trying to do now. We're trying to revive our thinking, re-engage with human study and knowledge of the world, the natural world, which the Quran tells us to do. And we're trying to slowly but surely get up, claw our way back to being the leading civilization. So unfortunately, this Sharia discussion is purely theoretical at this current point in time. What we are trying to bring it into implementation. Unfortunately, the powers that be would call people who want to implement this Sharia and this enlightened understanding as Islamists, as a misnomer, as a pejorative term. And they say, oh, Islamists taking over in Tunisia, Islamists taking over in Egypt, Islamists taking over in Libya. It's interesting, everywhere Muslims actually finally get some kind of rough kind of representative leadership, if you want to call it that, it's Islamists always come to power. That's what the Muslims want. We've had secular dictators upon us which have stopped us from applying Islam and trying to get towards the Sharia, to apply it in this enlightened form, its true form. And we're trying to, that's our struggle, that's our quote-unquote jihad. So this is, in a nutshell, why we decline, and inshallah, what we're trying to do now to remedy it.
I think it's just not really fair to say that the Islamists who are now ruling in Tunisia, Egypt, and Syria are those that will actually implement the enlightened Sharia we're looking for, because actually those today have nothing to do with the enlightened Sharia you were talking about.
Yeah.
I actually agree with you. You're right. The Islamists are, I suppose you could say, Islamist light in the Muslim world. And these are basically, because it's ancient. You had Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, these countries which are obviously roughly in that geographical location. And then you have the American pressure, the media, and all this pressurizing these religious parties to be liberal and not implement Sharia, and to prevent the implementation of Sharia, to limit it, to only have a few token laws or a few Islamic flavorings. And you have these Islamists who are reassuring the West. Why would they want to reassure the West? What's that to do with, what's the domestic political situation got to do with people outside that country? You don't see Britain reassuring the King of Saudi Arabia, for example, that, oh, we will apply a system that doesn't. You don't see that. So why are we must now reassure the outsiders as to that, no, but we're only in the full Sharia, only a little bit, just a tiny bit of it, you know? So, you know, like Sharia zero, or Sharia light, yeah? Yeah, but at least you're right. But the fact that the Muslims who blindly believe that the system has changed in their countries just because you've changed the faces, the Muslims believe it, they vote for them, that shows that the Muslims desire change, and they desire a Sharia-oriented change. Unfortunately, it's not being given them. The military junta of Egypt still control Egypt. They're given a military aid package by America, which is basically mercenary money to do what to American foreign policy, and the Egyptians know it. That's why there's lots of riots and problems. Anyway, it's a very big political mess, but my main point was that Muslims desire political change to establish a light Sharia, and we're being denied it, but you know, it's a matter of time, inshallah.
Any other questions?
There was a guy at the back who had a question. He was formulating a question for me.
Can you come back to me just in a minute?
Okay,
First, I'd like to thank you for your very thoughtful speech. I'm coming at this question from a Christian background, which you understand from your own, whereby the fundamental problem that a religion tries to address is one of general sinfulness and people doing wrong things. In Christianity, and as I'm sure you know, just to clarify, the problem is solved by the one perfect person, Jesus Christ, dying to take the punishment of that, so that the Christian can be certain of acceptability before God. My question is, can Sharia give the Muslim such certainty?
Okay. Well, certainty of salvation is a different debate topic, a different lecture topic. But just to put it like this, apparently the Bible, Jesus says, and this is off topic, sorry. But Jesus said in the Bible that there would be people who come to him on their judgment saying, Lord, Lord, and they would perform miracles in his name. Yeah, and he goes, no, I know you not. So my question to you as a Christian, how do you know that you're not one of those kind of Christians who Jesus will deny on their judgment? So there is no certainty. All there is faith and hope and belief and good works, and that's what Islam is. Islam is faith and good works, and that by the grace of God we'll be saved. The Sharia of Jews is a mercy, because it is not fair that God should, you could say, just allow us to create us for a purpose and not give us any guidance to fulfill this purpose, we'd stumble into an incorrect way of organizing human beings, which would cause oppression, injustice, and so on, and then we would do more wrong in that bad environment. So God wants us to be in a natural environment which is inclining us to do right. So we view the Sharia as a mercy to mankind, as a help from God to fulfill our purpose on the social level. Obviously, the Sharia won't make you a good Muslim. It won't go into your house and see, are you praying 5 times a day? You might not be. You might be drinking inside your house if you want. And the Sharia does not interfere with what you do inside your own house. It is prohibited to spy on people in the Sharia. The Prophet had prohibited this. There's a famous narration of Caliph Omar, where he heard some music, and he went, he just basically peeked over a wall, and he saw a guy being entertained by a dancing woman, and he was drinking alcohol, which obviously are things which are looked down upon, to the least in the Sharia. And you know, he said to him, shame on you for doing this. And the guy responded back to him, no, shame on you for basically peering into my house and breaching my privacy.
So Omar just basically said, okay, I'll just let it go, if you let it go. It's like, all right, well then, that's it. So Islam's not totalitarian. Islam won't make you, won't force you to be a pious believer. What it will do is prevent those people who don't want to be pious and who want to be immoral from infecting and corrupting society as a whole by introducing bad ideas or concepts or creating publicly available pornography or making, you know, gambling shops available for the poor people to be enticed by it and lose even more money and get into more debt, all these kind of things, because we are weak. That's why. But in private, that's up to you. That's between you and God. But it's here to protect the those of us who are not. There are four categories I like to say in Islam that are people that Islam deals with. One are the righteous people who are incorruptible. Islam doesn't come to regulate them. The Sharia does not come to regulate them. They'll always be righteous, right? The people who are always corrupted, yeah, they will always do the corrupted thing. Yeah, Islam came to prevent them from corrupting everyone else. But those people who are the hidden corrupted, like a hypocrite or munafiq, and those people who are the majority of us, who are trying to be good but failing, Islam came to regulate those two by denying the hypocrite the public means to spread his hypocrisy and to manipulate the situation to his interest. And it helps those who are trying to be good but are weak to help to be good, be virtuous. So this is the four categories that Islam basically looks at, and it doesn't deal with two of them, and it regulates two of them, you see. So this is, I think, the Islamic take on it. And inshallah, Islam, in implemented, will even help to make Christians better Christians and help Jews be better Jews, because we all have an Abrahamic common beliefs when it comes to various number of things.
Okay, thank you for asking this question. Actually, we had a topic yesterday, Jesus Christ, Prophet of God. But please, if you can keep the topic related to the subject, the question related to the topic. Yes, any questions on that side? Okay.
Actually, I have a comment which might emphasize the fact that Islam or Sharia law is not a barbaric law at all. Actually, it is. My argument is from history. We know all that Muslims ruled Spain for about 800 years. If really the hypothesis that Islamic law is barbaric, so why Muslims didn't kill Jewish or Christian in Spain? They didn't. They gave them the freedom of worshipping God, of thinking on the way of their religion. But after, you know, after when Christian ruled Spain, they killed and they tortured all Muslims. And the majority of them, they came to North Africa.
Is there a question? Question?
Yeah, it's a comment.
Yeah, it's a comment. Okay. Yeah. Any questions? Any questions?
Okay. It's not just Islamic Al-Andalus, which I come from. It's also in every Muslim country, you get the oldest churches in existence, not been broken down, or as the Islamophobes would say, oh, the Muslims denied Christians from rebuilding their churches. No, they've been rebuilt. They've been new ones. You'll find new churches in the Muslim world. Yeah, so Christians who have been living there, safe from persecution by Orthodox Christians from, like the Catholics, for example, medieval Catholics, and I'm not here to offend modern Catholics, but medieval Catholics were oppressing and killing heterodox Christian denominations who found safe haven in Muslim lands, because Muslims didn't care about what denomination Christian you were. And we're proud, as Muslims, to protect the Christians under our suzerainty. In fact, the Prophet Muhammad said that whoever harms a protected person, i.e. a person who is a non-Muslim living under Muslim land, has harmed me. Now, we love the Prophet Muhammad so much, we wouldn't see a single hair on his head be harmed. But the Prophet Muhammad said, whoever harms a non-Muslim has harmed me. And this is how much we protected and looked after non-Muslims in Islam. We're proud of this, absolutely proud. In fact, the only time where you see non-Muslims being attacked in any time in Islamic history was when they were actually, you saw in the 1500s, there was a very strange incident. I think it was because of the Crusades and all these kind of things made some very bad bias in some Muslim times. But there was some mob attacks by Muslims on Christians. And it was incited by a few poets who basically said that the Christians have it too good in the Muslim world, that the Islamic government gives them too many privileges, and if only we could be like the Christian, treat as the Christians were treated, then we wouldn't be the poor oppressed, the poor masses, poor Muslim masses. So you see Muslims, in essence a Muslim EDL, yeah, who were angry, thought the government was against Muslims and was supporting Christians because Christians are so nice. But that proves the point that the Islamic system applied by the state actually gives Christians the space to rule, and that's the exceptions prove the rule. You see, fanatical mobs of whoever they are, hooligans, they were actually the exception that proves the rule.
What do you think, as Muslims, who are kind of living in a society where most of the Sharia, which they should be following, is kind of repressed? And for example, in some societies where women be allowed to do some things which are part of Islam, what advice do you think you can give such Muslims? Do you think migration, because type of migration in some places where they are completely oppressed or something?
What's the advice? Oppressed? Are you talking in Western countries or Muslim countries?
No, I'm talking about in the Western countries where,
in Western countries?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, basically, as we all know, Islamophobia is, Muslims are the new Jews. And if you read all this research in World War II, pre-World War II Europe, everybody, it seems to be the majority of people in Europe dislike Jews for some reason. Maybe it was their culture, their different practices. Whatever the reason was, there was anti-Semitism all throughout Europe. And what was interesting is when World War II was initiated, when England gave the ultimatum to Germany, it was, leave Czechoslovakia and what have you, right? Leave Poland all these places, right? Well, what was Czechoslovakia? It didn't say, and if Germans do not stop oppressing their Jews, we will fight them. No, nothing about the Jews, nothing about how Germans were treating their Jews, absolutely nothing, just about what Germany was doing in its foreign policy in Europe. That was all. That was the only ultimatum that Britain gave Germany prior to the outbreak of World War II. So they didn't care about the Jews. And no one liked the Jews. Henry Ford, I think the car manufacturer, he was a very big anti-Semite in America. And now it's the Muslim's turn to be these demonized people. And perhaps for the same reasons. What I would say is that the best thing we could do is things like I'm doing now and things like what we should do is be open about our belief, understand our belief, and express and explain our belief to people. We're up against the media, who are sensationalist, so it's an uphill struggle, but the best thing we can do is be peaceful and explain what Islam is in the best possible way to the people. If things are getting really, really bad, then you maybe need to consider migration from a Western country. I don't think any French people, the French Muslims, who've left France and come to England, for example, because it's been obscenely oppressive and biased against Muslims there. But that's your choice, that'll be up to you. What I would advise is you try your best to try to reverse these stereotypes and do things which are counterintuitive to as they expect Muslims to do.
Any other questions? Okay, is that Kim? Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so you made your point about whether Islam or Sharia is barbaric or not. How do you respond to claims that it's hypocritical? How do you explain sort of temporary marriage contracts to get around adultery or prostitution and sort of things like that?
Okay. The temporary marriage contracts, generally speaking, Sunnis, who are the majority school of thought, don't believe in temporary marriage at all. And only a small section do believe in temporary marriage. But, as I always do, I play devil's advocate, I'll defend even the least desirable opinion and see it and test it. Let's take the worst case scenario, so to speak, and let's say multi-marriage, temporary marriage is allowed in Islam by the majority sect, which it isn't. What is multi-marriage? Muta marriage is basically that the two people get married for a fixed period of time. This is in a way no different to people getting married and don't like each other and then they divorce after a period of time as well. But just like divorce, or just like a normal marriage, if they have an offspring, if there's a children involved, if children comes out from Muta marriage, then it's an obligation of both parents to look after that child, even if it was only a temporary one. So the child is still looked after and maintained, there's obligation there. But so that's the key element of obviously marriage is that you, there is an environment where both parents look after the child. So the even the Muta marriage, which I don't, I don't advocate being a Sunni, even that, there is obligation and responsibility. So it's not like a boyfriend-girlfriend thing, certainly not like a boyfriend-girlfriend thing, which in a Western society, there is no responsibility. There is no any kind of responsibility. The only kind they was brought in is actually anti-freedom, according to the philosophy of it, which is basically child support. So, the man must support the child. But this is against the freedoms, to be against the freedom of the man and the woman, right? Or the man, so to speak. According to liberalism. But they realize that there are so many single parents out there, so many, they just, the state couldn't support all of them. And so they instituted this anti-liberal idea because it was unworkable, which is why I argue that liberalism, in its philosophy, does not apply, cannot be applied to human beings, it's unworkable, it's too anarchic. So that's my answer for Muta marriage. I don't, as a Sunni, I don't advocate Muta marriage, where the Sunnis are the majority sect. But even for those minority who do, there are still responsibilities that they can't get out of, and this is completely unlike the boyfriend-girlfriend relationship in the West.
Okay, I'm going to take two more questions. Two more. Okay, I'm going to take the gentleman down, and then the question from there.
My question is about the practice of Sunni. I missed part of the report, so I don't know what to say about it. But basically, are there any differences in the ways men and women are treated in this practice?
In
the practice of Sunni?
In the penal system, okay. Stoning is a capital punishment in Islam. It's done when a crime is proven, which requires four witnesses, i.e. Adultery. Four witnesses. Again, as I said before, it's unworkable. If that's exactly workable, why do four witnesses? You're going to find virtually no one that fulfills the criteria of four witnesses. Even if a husband or wife finds their spouse in bed with someone, that single testimony still doesn't count. So even if a husband accuses his wife of adultery, that doesn't count. And that can be cancelled out by the wife saying, I didn't commit adultery. And that's cancelled out. There's no punishment for that. So as I said, unless you're a public exhibitionist when it comes to adultery, it's an impractical punishment, as in it can't be applied. It seems to be only there for symbolic reasons. And the reason why it's stoning is because in the kind of cultural context, especially, for example, when Muslims go on Hajj, we stone the pillars which represent Satanism, and we reject this. Stoning is the public rejection of something. So if something is seen in the public, which undermines the basic unit of society, i.e. the family, then the society should come together and publicly reject this. And this is what the stoning is for. But again, as I said, it's designed mostly to be, if not almost exclusively, to be a preventive measure. It can't be implemented for witnesses, or you can find for witnesses. But to answer your question, are men and women treated differently? No. Men and women don't treat exactly the same.
Can I come back? Just come back on that. A Muslim told me that men are buried up to a lower level than women in the practice of stone.
Let's keep the question related to Islam, not to tradition. What's your question again?
About stone.
I suppose this comes up. We need to know about this. There is no, as far as I'm concerned, there's no provision for how men and women, how low they are on the earth being stoned or not. But generally speaking, I think it could have been introduced at some point to put women actually lower so that their bodies are not exposed to the stones, but just their head, which would probably be more merciful to women than it is for a man. Men are actually have more of their body exposed, and so probably men probably endure more pain, I suppose. But as far as I know, that's not any Islamic institute. So Islam has an institute, it hasn't given any guidelines for that. That was practiced by perhaps some cultural accretion or whatever. But the punishment for both men and women is generally the same. I think because out of more respect for women, they didn't want the clothes being ripped off the woman during stoning and exposing her body, so her body's more concealed, which actually is more beneficial, so to speak, for the woman than it is for the guy. Because for the guy, it would probably be, so it would be better than your head showing, basically. So the more, the lower you are in, the better. And the woman, because we, a kind of a tradition I've implemented.
I just wanted to add to it. It actually came from the Christian tradition and the Jewish tradition. Because when the Prophet was asked what should they do about a woman committing adultery, he said do what the previous generations did. And the Jews and the Christians did that. And that's my understanding.
Okay,
that's where the ruling came from.
Question for them.
I'm sorry if you already covered this, I came a bit late. But I just wanted to ask, what capacity is there for women to get involved in the political system of Islam?
Okay, that's a very good question. Well, basically, Islam enfranchised women from the get-go. So, for example, Aisha, she was a teacher, and even she led an armed protest. I think it was obviously against Ali, which is controversial, but it showed that women were given, women were listened to, and women were given kind of some precedence in their opinions. So in Islam, women have generally speaking, for all positions beneath the caliph, they have an equal ability to be publicly represented and have their opinions garnered in that system. So they can, and in terms of employment, obviously there's an absolute equality in this sense. A woman could be a manager, she can be a lawyer, she could be a judge, she could be a number of things. She could be an Islamic scholar, a qadi, whatever you have you considered in mind. In fact, the classical scholars like Imam Shafi, Abu Hanifa, and others they actually learned a lot of their belief about Islam, a lot of their understanding of Islam from women scholars who they actually rated to be higher than superior to them. And we don't hear much about these, but there were women hadith scholars in the early Islam. There's a wonderful book called Al Muhaddithat, which the guy details early Islam, how many Islamic scholars in hadith, which is the preservation of Prophet Muhammad's teachings and so on, there were, and he counted 6,000, and then he gave up off, and that's only within the first few hundred years. And it was too many. So women were allowed access to all positions of learning and public representation in terms of shura, in terms of consultation, even in the army, as they were allowed to participate from the time of Prophet Muhammad. So we had there were women soldiers in the army, and they were allowed, and women were allowed to vote. So the Prophet Muhammad, when he took the bay'ah, the Pledge of Allegiance, he took the Pledge of Allegiance from men and from women as well. And so this, in essence, is women's public representation, the first of its kind in the history of mankind, because obviously, as we know, in ancient Greece, in the democracy, only men were citizens, and women were not allowed to be citizens or vote. So this is how Islam allows equal participation in the political system for men and women.
One last question. Last question.
In regards to this,
okay, afterwards, please. Any last question from there? So, where is it now? Somewhere there? Okay, sister, there.
Yeah.
Yes?
I'm wondering, since I came to this, did you address the issue of fatwa anytime in your.
The issue of fatwa?
Yeah, it's something that is usually very much practiced in certain countries, for instance, mine. I mean, what does the Quran say? Is it misrepresented in practice?
Fatwa is very broad. What would you mean by
that? Mostly that happens is in villages. Mostly women are subjected to, you know, again, stoning or beating if they're found that they, you know, particularly it's not adult patients. Basically, what happens is if they're raped, they in turn actually get, you know, the blame.
I think you'll find out more about this in the talk tomorrow, where Sister Marion Ponsor will talk about women's rights and so on. But basically, the state of the Muslim world today is absolutely appalling when it comes to Islam. Women are not given due process in many of these so-called
courts in these countries. And they're basically very chauvinistic rulings which don't respect Islam. Men are allowed to get away with a lot of things. This turns many women away from Islam because they believe that what they're seeing is Islam, because the men keep saying it's Islam and it is not. You know, if we compare that to the rulings of the Prophet Muhammad to women who approached him asking for rulings, we see a vast gulf, a vast difference. It's absolutely appalling the way women are treated in the Muslim world. And the sooner we implement Sharia there, the sooner we can get rid of all these quacks who support this very wacky understanding of a traditionally mixed chauvinistic Islam, which is not even Islam.
Okay, on that we end. Thank you very much, Abdullah, for listening, and thank you all for coming. I want to quickly conclude by also one of the speakers who was at a different topic and was asked about Sharia law, and he said if there's a law that governs how a man, how a human being can live his life, if there's a law that governs how a man, a human being, not a Muslim, can live his life, and it's Sharia law. You only have a manual for something, you only buy a new device, new remote or new PC, whatever, and there's a remote for it. This remote, this is a manual, is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, from the Almighty God. I know this is a biased statement coming from a Muslim, but imagine the same Sharia law that says if two people are committing an act of adultery, you have to have four witnesses, says you are not a true believer, you're not a Muslim if your neighbor is living on an empty stomach, sleeping on an empty stomach. How many of us nowadays even know our neighbor's names? I'm sure most of you might know them, but actually the majority is quite less. And on that basis, I'd like to say that we have free copies of the Glorious Quran, and we also have free gift boxes. These gift boxes are made out of obviously some chocolates, and there's going to be selected verses of the Quran, a story that makes you think outside the box, the man with brown underpants, a CD, and it's very nice, and if I can just request, it's only for non-Muslims. So if you're Muslim, we'll get you some later, okay? And one other thing, if you are not on our mailing list, then please sign your name. Muslims, you should be, Muslim students, you should be on our mailing list, as the brother there is excitedly showing it. You should be on our mailing list, non-Muslims. If you would like to be kept up to date with events, please sign your name. If not, you can visit our official Facebook page, Sussex, that's Sussex, ISOC News, ISOC News, our website, www.usisoc.org.uk. Thank you all very much for coming. I'd like to remind you that tomorrow at the same time, there will be a talk about women in Islam by a news reporter who was captured by Taliban 4 days and then accepted Islam afterwards, and by Daniel Francois, another speaker as well, who's going to speak about it. They're very, very famous, and we really want to have them as well. Thank you very much.
الصلاة والسلام.